Welcome to this week's program with Samuel Adams Returns, The Anti-Federalists Got It Right. Hi, this is Kathy, joining with Tom to have a discussion about our most current event, the U.S. Senate. Tom believes that if we consider what the Senate has become, the Anti-Federalists were right during their Constitution ratification arguments. What was the intent of the framers of the Constitution for that upper house of Congress? Where did historic perspective come from, and what were some of the arguments concerning the Senate? We have a lot to discuss in this heated time of our nation as the mainstream media plays the manipulator in the political jousting for that, supposed to be, noble chamber of representation, the U.S. Senate. Don't forget to check out Tom's host page here at Liberty Works Radio Network. Find out more about him by visiting the website and Facebook links on the page. You can also find links to the previous program archives there too. Samuel Adams Returns, The Anti-Federalists Got It Right, is an affiliate of the National Center for the Development of Constitutional Strategies, whose purpose is to bring historical relevant solutions that have always been foundationally available from the inception of America to present-day issues. Please remember that Liberty Works Radio Network is a listener-supported network. Thanks for participating along with every other listening member who make this programming possible. Join the network, and thanks again for contributing as you can. With that said, what is all this hubbub about regarding the U.S. Senate?
First off, I'm really fired up about this topic. This topic has a number of challenges to overcome as we develop the whole essence of electing senators and even considering what makes a person qualified to sit in the federal Senate.
Hey, folks, we have to look out when Tom gets fired up because he has a lot of words and he's been known to talk nonstop. So tell us, what was the first challenge in understanding what the Senate is supposed to be all about?
Well, the first challenge is that the American citizenry do not have a simple, let alone a complex understanding of how the Senate became part of the U.S. Constitution. The historical purpose of the Senate has virtually been wiped from the memory of American citizenry over the last 100 years. The tragedy of this is that the balance of power that the framers of the Constitution intended has completely fallen into the pit of what was predicted by those having a contrary position and arguments during the ratification debates. Just to refresh everyone's thinking, those with the contrary opinions as to how great the original Constitution, you know, that was submitted to the states for ratification in 1787 were known as the Anti-Federalists. But in fact, they were the true Federalists when one looks at the applied definition of federalism. But you know what? We're going to have to cover that in another discussion in another day. The point we are trying to bring to everyone's vision and hearing is that there was a historical precedent set as to why the Senate was established as the chamber to be chosen by the state legislatures and not the general population.
Wait just a minute. Did you say that the general citizenry was not supposed to elect senators?
Yep, that's correct. We'll have to get the real reason why direct elections of the Senate are a bad thing next week. Anyway, let's get to some of the early considerations as to what the citizens of the revolutionary period might have been looking at when they were forming their individual state constitutions and looking at how the states would then come together for common purposes. I want to keep this consideration focused on how the various states' senates, in fact, came about and how they rationalized this body of representation then for the national legislature. So the first thing that we have to remember and put into the level of importance as that first consideration of governance is that the founders and framers had a moral foundation. This foundation was rooted in the Reformation and especially with the various writings of the Scottish Reformers. We have to remember and acknowledge that the colleges of the period were seminaries first and foremost. Additionally, we have to recall that the average age of those entering college was about 16 years old. Can you imagine that? And to do so, they had to have already completed, at a minimum, studies in reading and writing of Latin and Greek. This was so that they could read the classical literature of history, philosophy, and Christianity in their originals. And some of those that went to college even learned Hebrew. In fact, Thomas Jefferson was one of only several that actually even learned Anglo-Saxon as the language it originally was, so he could read and comprehend that form of governance and laws.
Okay, Tom, so why is all this important when we are wanting to talk about the upcoming Senate elections?
I never said we were going to talk about the upcoming Senate elections. It's critical to understand that the education of the founders and framers, as well as many of the citizens in revolutionary America, was morally based on Christianity, and that having a deep knowledge of history in its original context, unfiltered by the present-day UNESCO manipulation, allowed those founding citizens to examine the errors of other societies and government systems. They also had that great understanding of the complications and problems in systems like the English Parliament. Not only that, they were well aware of the results of the English Revolution and what was known as the English Constitution. Those were written into what became the citizens' rights that were initially established with the Magna Carta around 1215. Oh, and most people don't know about this. They were also very aware of the Charter of Liberties, also called the Coronation Charter, which was written as a proclamation by Henry I of England and issued upon his ascension to the throne in 1100. This charter sought to bind the king to certain laws regarding the treatment of nobles, church officials, and individuals. The 19th century historian, both of them, Frederick Maitland and Frederick Pollock, considered it a landmark document in English legal history and a forerunner to the Magna Carta. The document addressed abuses of royal power by the predecessors, which was William II, specifically over taxation of the barons, the abuse of vacant episcopal sees, and the practices of the act of selling church offices and what was called the role of pluralism, which was something that the Catholic church political offices were given in rewards and received in exchange for services rendered, and even retaining it for like a promise for some future services. By the way, the 1225 version of the Magna Carta, with the long title originally in Latin, which is English translation, the Great Charter of the Liberties of England and of the Liberties of the Forest, still remains on the statute books of England and Wales.
So what you're saying then is that the citizenry, as well as the key people that are named as founders or framers of American self-governance, were clearly aware of all of this history and more?
You know, that's correct, Kathy. To that point, one has to think about what John Adams wrote to Thomas Jefferson on July 16, 1814, regarding his studies in historical writings. Adams wrote, "I'm very glad you have seriously read Plato, and still more rejoiced to find that your reflections upon him so perfectly harmonize with mine. Some 30 years ago, I took upon me the severe task of going through all his works. With the help of 2 Latin translations, and 1 English, and 1 French translation, and comparing some of the most remarkable passages with the Greek, I labored through the tedious toil. My disappointment was very great. My astonishment was greater, and my disgust was shocking." This was a response to Jefferson's detestation and denouncement of Plato's Republic. Jefferson wrote, quote, "While wading through the whimsies and puerilities and unintelligible jargon of his work, I laid it down often to ask myself how it could have been that the world should have so long consented to give reputation to such nonsense as this, fashion and authority apart, and bringing Plato to the test of reason, take from him his sophisms, his futilities, and incomprehensibilities, and what remains?" End quote. Now, folks, remember that socialism, communism, humanism, and the other isms have deep roots in Plato. And you know what? If most of the listeners don't comprehend the words used by Jefferson, it isn't because of colonial English was a weird thing. It is because the educational system of today, led by UNESCO and the NEA, have dumbed down we the people in true literary abilities that were once common language to every American citizen. It is critical to mention here that the ability to read in colonial America was about 90% of all the adult male population.
Wow.
So now, When references were made to the likes of John Locke, everyone not only could read Locke for themselves, but they absolutely understand what he was talking about in the context of their political situations. So, you know, before you can understand some of the arguments during the constitutional debates, you have to begin with the very fundamental concepts that Locke talks about. You know, he wrote in his second treatise on government, and I want to quote this: "Whenever, therefore, any number of men are so united into one society as to quit every one of his executive power of the law of nature, and to resign it to the public, there and there only is a political or civil society. And this is done wherever any number of men in the state of nature enter into society to make one people, one body politic under one supreme government, or else when anyone joins himself to and incorporates with any government already made. For thereby he authorizes the society, or which is all one, the legislative thereof, to make laws for him as the public good of the society shall require, to the execution whereof his own assistance as to his own decrees is due. And this puts men out of the state of nature into that of a commonwealth by setting up a judge on earth with authority to determine all the controversies and redress the injuries that may have happened to any member of the commonwealth, which judge is a legislative or magistrate appointed by it. And wherever there are any number of men, however associated, that have no such devices of power to appeal to, there they are still in the state of nature." So what Locke was saying was that the basics here that everyone understood at the time was that being in a state of nature was, in essence, your individuality with all human rights intact as God created you. So that if you were a hermit in the desert, the jungle, or elsewhere, your single sense of accountability and dependency was relative to your full and unhampered position in the created world. You would only be held accountable to the moral laws of God that are seen in nature. Better described via Locke, in the state of nature, all men are free to order their actions and dispose of their possessions and persons as they think fit, within the bounds of the laws of nature. The state of nature has a law of nature to govern it, and that law is also reason. You know, so here we have that Locke believes that reason teaches that no one ought to harm another in his life, liberty, or property, and that the transgressions of this may be punished. This view of the state of nature is partially deduced from Christian beliefs. What Locke is also telling us is that we voluntarily join a society, and when we do that, we authorize that leadership or legislature to make responsible laws that will not only maintain our position of individuality and rights, but will ensure the mutual protection of those core aspects of the state of nature, while making sure that it is for all the common good.
But how does that apply to the Senate?
In Chapter 9 of these treaties, Locke talks about the legislature. He sets the stage with, quote, "Though the legislative, whether placed in one or more, whether it be always in being or only by intervals, though it be the supreme power in every commonwealth, yet, first, it is not, nor can possibly be absolutely arbitrary over the lives and fortunes of the people, for it being but the joint power of every member of society given up to that person or assembly, which is the legislature. It can be no more than those persons had in a state of nature before they entered into society and gave up to the community."
So when we begin to talk about the legislature overall, we have to know that what they do cannot be arbitrary and cannot do more than what you or I would do if we were acting morally as individuals.
At the root of it all, that is correct. In the next segment, we'll get into more of what Locke said that explains the principles argued during the convention that establishes the original intent of the U.S. Senate. When you pick up all the notes on the convention, that is Yates as well as Madison, you'll see that the words of Locke and others echo through those mirrors of time we mentioned in our first broadcast.
I can't wait to continue our discussion in the next segment. This has been a great introduction to the historical background that the citizens of the Foundation understood as truth.